The passage we're looking at today, following on from what we heard about Peter and Judas a week ago, if you were here, is verse 63 of chapter 22. The experience of phoning a business with our inquiry, only to explain our problem first to one person, who then transfers us to another, and then to one of their colleagues, and then another person, and so on, is frustrating enough. But that is nothing to what Jesus suffered when, after his arrest, he is bundled unceremoniously from one authority to the next, and the next, and the next. From the temple guards, to the Jewish council, to Pilate, the Roman governor, to Herod, back to Pilate again, and then, as we know, to the place of crucifixion. And first, we're going to follow the Jesus trail, blow by blow, literally sometimes. And then towards the end, we're going to spend the last few minutes deciding what images or what impressions, vivid images, we will take away with us of the whole extraordinary affair. So let's begin with the soldiers in verses 63 to 65. Because first, we're going to see that the soldiers ill-treated Jesus, which is an example of human cruelty. Now, surely, these soldiers had no personal quarrel with Jesus. And yet, they attacked him verbally and physically, taking advantage of a prisoner who couldn't fight back. Verse 63, the men who were guarding Jesus began mocking and beating him. They blindfolded him and demanded, "Prophesy, who hit you?" Perhaps in their boredom, they got a kick out of using their weapons on a defenseless victim. The renowned journalist Robert Fisk's book, The Great War for Civilization, is a good but quite a long read. But each time I get it out, it reminds me of the horrors of appalling torture, often recorded from Afghanistan or Iraq or Iran, but also from non-Middle Eastern powers, sometimes from the West, who either ignore what is happening in countries it is convenient for them to support or serve up their own brands of inhumanity. Now, the treatment of prisoners is raising important questions. Are the guards abusing their position or simply doing their job realistically? How can we at home fully understand the pressures these soldiers face when under constant threat themselves? And yet, the principle of fair treatment of those in their charge is an international human rights issue that Christians do well to be concerned about. Amnesty International has been promoting a 12-point program for the prevention of torture, and I know that some people here in this church support that. Jesus could identify with those on the receiving end of human cruelty, and all of us are capable of cruelty in one form or another. And so we move on to the next set of verses, 66, to the end of the chapter. And here we're going to be looking at the Jewish council. A council, secondly, that condemned Jesus, an example of religious extremism. Now, the term religious extremism carries overtones today that makes us cautious about the way that it should be used. As Christians, we are aware that we are sometimes accused of being extremists, simply for holding certain Christian convictions that we maintain from our allegiance to Scripture. The official Jewish council, 70 strong, plus the high priest, they met at crack of dawn on the day we now call Good Friday, after a couple of preliminary hearings with the high priest during the night, which are mentioned in other Gospels. So look at verse 66. At daybreak, the council of the elders of the people, both the chief priests and the teachers of the law, met together, and Jesus was led before them. Technically, they were putting Jesus on trial, and yet as we read through, we see it was a farce, because they would only accept one outcome. And the extremism is demonstrated in at least three ways. First of all, no justice. Having failed to obtain a result through the use of false witnesses, they now concentrated on extracting a confession from Jesus. Anything they could use to accuse him of blasphemy. Verse 67, they ask, "If you are the Christ, tell us." And at first, Jesus declines to answer. He knows they're not genuinely interested in discovering the truth about him. And then when pressed, "Are you then the Son of God?" he replies with a phrase which is slightly curious to us. "You are right in saying that I am." In other words, Jesus is saying, "You are putting your words into my mouth, but I certainly won't deny them." Twice recently I've heard BBC presenters setting a yes or no question. And then if the answer doesn't quite come in the form that they want, they then say, "I'll take that as a yes. End of interview." Rather like the Jewish council, what Jesus had said, they decided was enough to satisfy them. "Did you hear that?" they said triumphantly. "He's committed blasphemy." End of trial. Extremism has a tendency not to want to listen or engage in any meaningful way. And in this particular case, those who were accusing Jesus, they couldn't care less what Jesus was trying to say. Jesus challenged the Sanhedrin as to the genuine nature of their questioning. But their objective was not justice, only grounds for imposing the death penalty. So no justice and then no clemency either. And there is a brutality about all of this, because the council would accept nothing other than death. And as we read through the Gospels, we see that theirs was an attitude which had been stoked up over 3 years of increasing jealousy and hatred. And in this case, it was so strong that even those from opposing factions or disagreements, they joined forces in a ruthless determination to destroy their common enemy. And then no democracy either. The attitude of the Jewish leaders towards the crowds, the general Jewish public, is very revealing. When public opinion supported Jesus, then it says that the leadership was afraid of them. As Luke recorded two chapters earlier, in chapter 20, it was that fear that had prevented them from arresting Jesus in the past. And this explains the staggering speed of the whole operation, from arrest to crucifixion, which happened in only a few hours, which the Sanhedrin wanted done and dusted before the crowds who had welcomed Jesus on Palm Sunday could come to intervene. And yet, as well as a fear of the people sometimes, they didn't hesitate to use those attracted by the goings-on outside Pilate's residence for their own purposes. They incited them to shout for Jesus to be crucified, so that those who were simply passing by that morning were formed into a crazed mob, so aroused that they could say crazy things like, "His blood be on us and on our children." Now, extremists, perhaps, as far as we're concerned, are always other people. And let's face it, sometimes they are. The world is at the mercy of a very deadly threat. And yet, we are wise if we make sure that we don't take on the wrong kind of extremist tendencies ourselves. With those with whom we strongly disagree, and perhaps with very good reason, are we fair-minded and just in our decisions? Do we listen and not just condemn? Are we unnecessarily aggressive? And do we respect people, or do we tend to use them when it suits our own purposes? Whether the Jewish council met all the criteria for the title extremist is open debate. But there are certainly grounds for considering that they met some of them. Their own ends, to which they were fanatically driven, removed any desire for justice, any feelings of clemency, and any respect for the people. And before we move on, it's important for us to note that numerous times in history, notably with the Holocaust, the Jewish people have suffered terribly themselves because of cruel and powerful extremists. And we're all responsible for ensuring that anti-Semitism is never allowed to flourish again. Now, having achieved their purpose of getting Jesus' confession of blasphemy, very useful for inciting the crowd a bit later, the council then took Jesus to see Pilate, the Roman governor. And so we come to number 3, and we enter chapter 23. Verse 1, "Then the whole assembly rose and led him off to Pilate." And as we look at Pilate, we see an example in powerful weakness. The Sanhedrin had recently lost its right to sentence a man to death. Pilate held that power. Already he had a grim record of using it. He was a tyrant, and eventually one particular massacre of numbers of Samaritans would lead to his dismissal in AD 36. The Jewish leaders knew that blasphemy would be of little interest to Pilate, so they changed tack, and in front of the representative of Rome, they decided to accuse Jesus of high treason. As we see in verse 2, they began to accuse him, saying in front of Pilate, "We have found this man subverting our nation. He opposes payment of taxes to Caesar and claims to be Christ, the king." Jesus had already indicated he did not oppose taxes for Caesar, but his accusers were short of ammunition. And what is interesting to us, I think, as we look through this chapter again this morning, is that we realize that everything convinced Pilate that this man, Jesus, was not guilty. And having considered the charges and questioned the accused, Pilate plainly and unequivocally pronounces his verdict that he is innocent. Look at verse 4. Then Pilate announced to the chief priests and the crowds, "I find no basis for a charge against this man." Now, as far as we're concerned, particularly if we're well within the Christian faith, we probably had come to this passage knowing that Jesus was totally innocent. But what is interesting is to hear it from somebody like Pilate, who's a neutral. So, Lord, what lay behind his conviction that Jesus was an innocent man? Let's look at these very briefly. First of all, there was Roman justice itself. Pilate had followed a clear code of practice, of which Luke only provides the briefest of summaries. Second, there was his suspicion of Jesus' enemies. Why were they suddenly so concerned for Roman interests? They weren't usually. And another gospel says that Pilate knew that they were motivated only by envy and spite. And then thirdly, there was Jesus himself. A king he may be, concluded Pilate. But he was obviously not the kind of king who posed any political threat to Pilate or to the Roman Empire. And fourthly, behind his conviction was his own wife, never a force to be taken lightly. But anyway, in this case, Pilate's wife had had a very unusual dream, and it persuaded her that her husband must not give in to the crowds. And then the last reason behind his desire to free Jesus, for once, was his own conscience. Otherwise, why would he defy the insistence of his accusers and the growing unrest of the mob with three separate declarations that Jesus was innocent? Like in verses 13 to 15 over the page, Pilate called together the chief priests and the rulers and the people, and he said to them, "You brought me this man as one who was inciting the people to rebellion. I've examined him in your presence and have found no basis for your charges against him." And nor, incidentally, he said, was Herod. And then further down in verse 22, the third time, it says, "What crime has this man committed? I have found in him," says Pilate, "no grounds for the death penalty." One commentator looked at this chapter and wrote, "Pilate did everything in his power to discharge Jesus, short of discharging him." And so we're bound to ask, what made Pilate, holding the power in the situation and very sure of his own ground, what made him give way? Why did it end up with what we see in verses 23 and 24, that Pilate decided to grant their demand? And there is, of course, a very simple answer, and it's the answer of weakness. And because it's not only the Pilates of this world who are at risk of being weak, I think it's good for us to take the opportunity to consider quite carefully how Pilate, and therefore how potentially we, can just as easily end up falling into this trap. It seems that the first reason why he was weak, or shown in his weakness, was hesitation. When Pilate gave his initial verdict, he should then have taken the normal step of releasing Jesus immediately and sending everybody home. But instead, he allowed the confrontation to continue. And we know from our own experience of living, perhaps when we've been under some form of temptation, once we have hesitated to act decisively, when we know full well what we should do, we become increasingly vulnerable. He or she who hesitates is lost. Last Monday evening, I got home in time to watch a television program which looked back 60 years to the independence of India, perhaps a little bit before your time. Mountbatten, in those days, was the Viceroy of India, charged by the British government with overseeing the process. It wasn't an easy task, but he would have had sympathy for Pilate. Mountbatten came on the scene holding the view that partition into India and Pakistan was not the best way forward. But in the end, he bowed to the pressure of bloody violence, terrible it was, and he just felt he had to allow partition to take place, because by that stage, there was no real alternative. Maybe, suggest some historians with the luxury of being able to look back on that situation, maybe it could all have been different if the authorities, including the British, had acted earlier. Like for Pilate, it was now too late. Hesitation. And another sign of weakness came out in what we might call avoidance. If you're looking at verses 6 to 12, which so far we've missed out, you'll see a little bit there about Herod. Because Pilate had a flash of inspiration, so he thought. He would pass the buck. He would get Herod involved. After all, Jesus said that he came from Galilee. But it turned out that Herod was useless. He didn't share Pilate's dilemma. All he wanted from the prisoner was for his curiosity to be satisfied with a royal performance. He wanted a miracle. And Jesus refused to cooperate. And that, apart from a mocking, was that. And it reminds us, when the decision is actually ours, no one else can take it for us. And then thirdly, about his weakness, was compromise. Now, I don't want to suggest that compromise is always wrong. In fact, there are occasions when it may be very wise to compromise when nothing fundamental is at stake. But just listen to what Pilate was saying if you look at verse 16. He's saying, in effect, I'll give the prisoner, he told the crowd, I'll give the prisoner a proper scourging. He won't get off scot-free, and then I'll release him. Sometimes an issue is so basic, like this one, we cannot justify compromise. At times we may not be certain whether it's fundamental or not, and that is always going to be difficult. But this time there could be no doubt. An attempt to compromise in situations like this is always going to be a sign of weakness. Now, just reading through this passage is quite a painful experience. It's been a very sorry tale of human cruelty, extremism, and weakness. And there has been a certain predictability about it all. However, for the last few minutes, I want to present you with three images to take home with you. Each of them could make the front cover of the newspaper the day after the trial of Jesus. Just picture these three things. The first image is a close-up of Barabbas. And that is a picture of sheer disbelief. After all, who would have given Barabbas a chance at the start of Good Friday? The choice being offered to the crowd was, Sir Pilate, I'm quite willing to free either Barabbas or Jesus. And verse 19 reminds us that Barabbas had been imprisoned, probably awaiting execution, for crimes of insurgency and for murder. Surely the comparison between Barabbas and Jesus on this occasion was no contest. And yet, incredibly, they chose freedom for Barabbas and not for Jesus. And by all accounts, it wasn't even close. And that is a very disturbing image for us to take home today. The crowd didn't listen to reason. They only listened to one another. And 20 centuries later, that is still a tragic reality. The offer on the table today is not freedom for Jesus, but freedom through Jesus. And yet, there are still surprising choices being made. People can still and do opt for an alternative. It's because the crowd often goes with the crowd. And the crowd will often as not follow the fashion, the media, or the mood of the day. So the first image, rather depressing one, is the look of disbelief on Barabbas. He was a free man. The second image is a close-up of Jesus. Perhaps we've been so busy looking at the cruelty and the extremism and everything else that's being on around him, that actually we've forgotten that here is Jesus there throughout, a picture of quiet patience. And if Barabbas was disturbing, then this view of Jesus is inspirational. A couple of weeks ago, we opened with a hymn about the cross of Jesus, including the words that when we look at the cross, it teaches his people and inspires us to suffer and to die. Often we pray for our persecuted brothers and sisters in places like North Korea or Iraq. But we know that one day they may be praying for their persecuted brothers and sisters in Britain. Already, some of us here in particular may have had a severe taste of suffering on behalf of Jesus. But when that persecution comes, when that suffering comes to us, our inspiration is Jesus himself. It's not only the promises that we have, how we'll be cared for at that time, and how we'd be given words to speak and so on. It is actually having that view of Jesus as he went towards the cross. He may have been the victim, but throughout all the mocking and the beating and the shouting and the sentencing, he was quiet, dignified, and patient. Certainly left its impression on Peter, because when Peter was writing his first letter, he said this to those of us who read it today. "To this you were called," he said, "because Christ suffered for you, leaving you an example that you should follow in his steps. When they hurled their insults at him, he did not retaliate. When he suffered, he made no threats. Instead, he entrusted himself to him who judges justly." And the last image to take away is another view of Jesus, but a different view, because this is a picture of supreme authority. And this picture of supreme authority was a picture that Jesus showed to the chief priests during his trial, but they missed it. They were too busy trying to secure his confession. If you look back at that episode at the end of chapter 22, just look at what it says. Jesus says, "If I tell you the answer to your question, you won't believe me," verse 67 and 68. "And if I asked you, you wouldn't answer. But," and this is the bit that they missed, "from now on, the Son of Man will be seated at the right hand of the mighty God." The council assumed that they were in control now, judging Jesus. The real truth was that it was and would be Jesus as judge of them. Jesus was raised to an authority far beyond that of the Sanhedrin, the Roman governor, even of Caesar himself. And perhaps poor old Pilate, in his heart of hearts, knew that. Notice that Jesus, when he said this, called himself the Son of Man. And that term, Son of Man, is not a term here emphasizing his ordinary humanity. It was a phrase every Jew would connect to its well-known use in the Old Testament in Daniel chapter 7. So as I finish with these words, I suggest that we look at the prisoner who is apparently, only apparently, at the mercy of his accusers as we listen to this image of Jesus Christ. "In my vision, I looked and there was before me one like a Son of Man. He was given authority, glory, and sovereign power. All peoples, nations, and people of every language worshipped him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away, and his kingdom is one that will never be destroyed." It's a difficult image for a newspaper editor to portray literally on his front page, but it is one that gives us all the reassurance and all the confidence that we need.